Afghanistan is now 5 months into Taliban rule. The bombs have stopped falling, but life hasn't improved for most Afghans.
One of the tragedies of this moment is that the United States is behaving as if it is done with Afghanistan.
Humanitarian groups say Washington still needs to lead. Also today, one silver lining of the pandemic, the ability to work from wherever. For many Bulgarians, that's been truly life-changing.
People feel like they hit the jackpot when they were able to move to the U.S. But for me, Bulgaria was always home.
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, North Korea launches yet another missile.
The first reaction is background noise, almost. The idea of North Korea up to its old antics type of thing. This time it is different.
We'll tell you why. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The World Health Organization issued a sobering prediction today. More than half of Europeans could be infected with the Omicron variant within the next 6 to 8 weeks. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., we're averaging an astonishing 775,000 new cases each day over the past week. Joining us now is epidemiologist Ali Mokhtad. He's with the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Dr. Mokhtad, what do you make of this warning that more than half of Europeans could get infected by the Omicron variant?
Well, our projections have shown that about 50% of Europeans will be infected. And in fact, we are estimating right now that the infections in the European Union will go to 4.9 million by January 12. Reported cases, detected cases, will rise to 1.9 million by January 24. So we're going to have a couple of difficult months ahead of us with this variant.
Why do you think the WHO also has warned that the Omicron variant shouldn't be treated like a flu-like illness?
I mean, look at it from this angle. Many of us, old generation, got chicken pox as kids because we didn't have a vaccine at that time. And right now we have to take a shingle vaccine because the virus is still dormant in us and could cause a lot of pain and a lot of diseases. We don't know the long-term effect of Omicron, so it's better not to treat it as a flu, and it's better to prevent getting infection through vaccines and wearing a high-quality mask.
Yesterday, Spain's prime minister said his country would start to track the pandemic differently because it's just not as deadly any longer. Is this a smart approach, in your opinion?
Yes, for Omicron, there is no need to test people who are not who are asymptomatic simply because 50% of them will turn positive. And you don't need to do that unless there is a decision to be made after a positive test, whether you go back to work or not, travel or not. Otherwise, we should do things differently right now.
What about here in the U.S.? We've seen massive numbers come in day after day. Like Europe, could half of Americans eventually be infected? I mean, what's the trajectory here?
Yes, we are estimating the same here in the United States. Actually, globally, that 50% of the population globally will be infected. Right now in the United States, we estimate that the peak in infections has occurred on January 6 at 6.2 million, and we project that the peak in reported cases will happen on January 19 at 1.2 million.
When do you think we might see a downward tick or trend of infection rates for the Omicron variant?
Yes, it's peaking around now. It will be coming down. It will be coming down as fast as it went up in Europe, everywhere in the world. Unfortunately, it's overwhelming the hospitals already, and we will still see a rise in hospitalization because there is a delay from hospitalization after an infection. It takes some time to people to show up at the hospital. Although we have seen a peak in infections, but not in reported cases, the peak in hospitalization is coming within 2 weeks.
Do we know how effective the booster shot and the new pharmaceutical meds coming out now have been against the variant?
The booster shot is highly effective against preventing severe illnesses. It goes up to 70%. Two doses, unfortunately, after 6 months, the protection goes down to about 50%. This has been widely documented through a lot of studies from all over the world, Qatar, Israel, the UK, and here in the United States. So a booster is highly effective against a severe illness, and it's very important right now to protect our hospitals, and that's the only tool we have at hand right now is through these vaccines and boosters to protect our hospitals, and of course, wearing a high-quality KN95 or N95 mask, avoiding gatherings.
Lastly, the CDC recommends a 5-day isolation period for COVID-positive people. What do you make of this recommendation?
you know, again, we're changing the way we are dealing with this virus because of the sheer number of infections. Before, we had 10 days. Now we set 5 days. CDC does not require a test. The debate here, should we send people back to work when they can still be possibly infectious and infect everybody else? The answer should be no, definitely. However, we are reaching a point right now because of the high number of infection that we may have to call some of our staff to hospitals, to essential workers, to make sure that we keep the country running, even knowing that they could still be infectious and they need to wear a high-quality mask. So we need to change the way we do things.
Dr. Ali Mokhtad is an epidemiologist with the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. He joined us from Seattle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control has 4 levels of travel advisories for countries: low COVID risk, moderate, high, and ding, 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 very high. That means travelers should avoid going there, and if they must, make sure they're fully vaccinated. Omicron surges have put so many countries in that level 4, more than 80. New to the list this week, Canada.
I'm surprised it came at all, because to be honest, both countries are in a very bad situation.
Kelly Lee is a professor of global health at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. She says it's a little late for this kind of advisory if the aim is to protect people from infections.
It just doesn't make any sense from a risk point of view if you have the same amount of virus level circulating in both countries, which is dire.
The border between the U.S. and Canada shut in March 2020 when the pandemic started, but it had been opening back up. Over the summer, Canada lifted its testing requirements for U.S. travelers. In the fall, the U.S. lifted its travel ban on dozens of countries, including its neighbor to the north. Lee studies cross-border policies and says they tend to be political, a way for governments to show the public they're trying to protect them. She isn't sure if that's what's happening with this announcement.
It might be performative, and it might be just trying to take some pressure somewhere, avoiding making a bad situation worse, you know, getting people to reduce their social contact.
Despite her own best efforts and being fully vaccinated, Lee herself contracted COVID right before Christmas. She says weeks later, she still has symptoms.
I actually play hockey, so I tried to skate and I just found I couldn't get my breath. So that was really worrying, and I'm a pretty fit person.
She doesn't wish even a so-called mild case of COVID on anyone. As for Canada's policies, last month the government advised all of its residents to avoid non-essential travel across the border. Period. End of story. Whether that's travel to the United States or to anywhere else around the globe. The Biden administration announced $300 million in new financial aid for Afghanistan today. The U.S. will also be sending more than 4 million doses of coronavirus vaccines. That assistance comes at a critical time for Afghanistan. Since the Taliban took over last summer, the country has lost a lot of the international aid that helped keep the economy afloat. And that's far from the only challenge faced by many ordinary Afghans. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Since the Taliban took power on August 15th, life for 33-year-old Wahida Amiri has been one shock after another. First, she lost her job. She was a librarian. Then she was told she can't leave her home without a male relative. And now she's witnessing a humanitarian disaster unfold in her country. We lost our identity and our dreams, she tells me, from her home in Kabul. The Taliban say they want an inclusive government, but so far their actions paint a different picture. Amiri and other women activists are not staying quiet. Starting just 3 days after the Taliban came to power, they went to the streets to protest, and they haven't stopped. We have gone out to protest many times, she says. We're demanding that the Taliban allow teenage girls back into schools. Education is a basic human right, she says. Amiri says the Taliban's response has been fierce. Protesters have been beaten, tear gassed, and threatened. Amiri recorded this video in December from the backseat of a taxi. She had just left the protest. Through tears, she explains how Taliban men attacked women protesters, firing shots in the air. Are we not human, she asks. Our lives have been upended. We have no future. The Taliban takeover happened fast. Even the group's leaders seemed caught off guard by how quickly they were back in power. Omar Samad used to be Afghanistan's ambassador to Canada and France. He's now with the Atlantic Council, a think tank in Washington.
On one hand, they have been very busy consolidating power. On the other hand, they have had to relearn or learn from scratch how to govern.
The Taliban were in power for a short period in the 1990s, but now Samad says they are facing the realities of actually running a country of some 40 million people.
They do not seem to have enough people who can handle technical aspects of governance. And on top of all of this, of course, we have seen this very troubling humanitarian crisis unfold in Afghanistan.
The World Food Programme estimates that 98% of Afghans don't have enough food to eat. UNICEF says 1 million children are on the brink of famine.
The numbers that we're looking at far exceed the combined total civilian casualties from the various armed attacks that took place in Afghanistan over 20 years.
Fanula Ni-Aline is the special rapporteur on counterterrorism and human rights with the United Nations. She says unless there is a major shift, the humanitarian crisis could turn out to be worse than the war itself. Last month, after much pressure, the United Nations lifted some restrictions on humanitarian aid. A good step, says Ni-Aline, but it's not enough.
A one-year reprieve is what I have likened to shuffling deck chairs on the Titanic, where humanitarian actors get a small amount of time to do work that simply cannot be done.
The world needs to engage with the Taliban, she says. But that's not a top priority for the Biden administration.
One of the tragedies of this moment is that the United States is behaving as if it is done with Afghanistan because it decided to leave. The leadership moment is not in walking out. The leadership moment is in what you do afterwards.
The financial aid for Afghanistan announced by the Biden administration today will bring the total U.S. assistance up to $780 million. That money will flow through aid organizations and not the Taliban. Meanwhile, people inside Afghanistan are not only fighting hunger, but also Taliban's harsh rule. That's according to Sami Mahdi, a journalist and university lecturer.
They have oppressed women, they have oppressed minorities, they have continued punishment of people on the streets, they have outlawed music.
Taliban pressure has not stopped Afghan women from protesting. Wahida Amiri, the activist, told me sometimes they gather in living rooms and basements. They hold up signs that read, "Education is a human right," and "Work, bread, freedom." They then post photos and videos online. Amiri says she will continue to raise her voice despite the risks. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
If another North Korean missile test sounds like New Year, same story, then stick around. Plus, the Supreme Court looks at whether the rules can be different for holding citizens and non-citizens in custody indefinitely. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Another day, another missile test. Sometimes that's how it feels on the Korean Peninsula, but this time seems a bit different. North Korea tested a ballistic missile that appears to be more sophisticated. And just a few days ago, the nation also allegedly tested a hypersonic missile. That's a missile that's so fast it can sneak by missile defense systems designed to shoot it down. Joining me now to break all of this down is John Park, the director of the Korea Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. John, what do we know about yesterday's test and what makes it unusual?
Carol, what we're piecing together, and this is information coming from the South Korean Ministry of National Defense and other sources, is that this particular missile exceeded Mach 10. But each of these demonstrations show that North Korea is diversifying its different capabilities when it comes to delivering a nuclear arsenal.
What actually is a missile test? Are they actually testing to gain insight into these weapons, or is it just really sending a message?
So the tests are a learning by doing process. And so there have been episodes in the past where you have had spectacular explosions and disasters. One part of the rationale that we're trying to discern is related to the broader picture of what happened in Hanoi. And this is February of 2019, where Kim and Trump met in their last major summit meeting. North Korea had offered to dismantle Yongbyon, what they view as the crown jewel in the nuclear weapons program, in return for the lifting of five of the 11 UN Security Council resolution sanctions. The United States said that wasn't sufficient. They viewed Yongbyon as essentially a declining, almost derelict type of facility that wasn't that much use and that much value in negotiating terms. After the collapse of Hanoi, you saw the North Koreans very clearly stating that they are going to enhance their capability, almost as if signaling that they don't want to be put in that position again, where there are questions about the value of what they put on the table. And so one interpretation is that these type of demonstrations of advanced capabilities raises the negotiating price of their program. And so it could be the prelude eventually after the North Koreans determine that they are ready for some kind of negotiations.
From your point of view, is this kind of escalation a good policy for North Korea?
In many respects, it's been the Seoul playbook.
You know, I started this story out by saying, gee, you know, another day, another missile test from the Korean Peninsula. Does that feel kind of sort of flippant in terms of what's actually going on here? That do you think, no, we really need to pay attention to this stuff?
When we first hear of alerts and news reports about North Korean missile tests, the first reaction is background noise, almost, the idea of North Korea up to its old antics type of thing. This time it is different. It is a diversification of the delivery systems of their nuclear arsenal. And so this makes their nuclear arsenal as it currently exists that much more potent in terms of what North Korea aspirationally wants to achieve.
John, how often do you sit there and wonder what's going on in these nuclear negotiators' minds?
You know, at the end of the day, it's fascinating because when you look at the very small group of individuals in the world who sat down at the negotiating table with North Korea, every single one of those negotiators have subsequently seen their nuclear agreement fall apart. We all have a constructed reality of what North Korea is. You know, very few individuals have that type of regular interaction, and they know their counterpart across the table, as it were. So in that gap, we're seeing all these developments play out. So the room for dramatic underestimation, dramatic overestimation of North Korea, perhaps is the widest among all the countries that we deal with in the international community.
John Park is the director of the Korea Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
The Supreme Court heard arguments about two important immigration cases today. They center on whether undocumented immigrants can be held in custody by immigration officials indefinitely. A decision is expected this summer. The World's Monica Campbell is here to talk about these cases and what's at stake. Monica, what's the main question before the justices today?
Justices heard two cases today. Both consider how long the federal government can detain undocumented immigrants in detention centers, in ICE custody, without a bond hearing, without going in front of a judge who can decide whether or not they can wait out their case beyond a jail-like setting. And it's a pressing matter because it's not unusual for immigrants to remain in ICE detention for long periods of time, well over a year, without any chance of a bond hearing. The lower federal courts have battled over this, so now we'll see if the Supreme Court decides this once and for all.
So non-citizens and citizens are treated differently in custody. Can you spell out those differences?
Of course, if you're a U.S. citizen and you're detained, you have a right to a bond hearing to seek bail. That is not the case for all undocumented immigrants in ICE custody. People can be held for long periods of time without a bond hearing. That may seem surprising, but that is the way it works in much of the country, including among immigrants who are fighting to stay in the U.S., who are actually actively fighting their deportation.
What's the government's argument for keeping this policy in place?
Well, the Biden administration argues that there's no part of the law that states that immigrants must have the opportunity to see a judge after a particular amount of time. And the sticking point here is 6 months. The lawyers who are representing the undocumented immigrants in front of the Supreme Court, that's where they're seeing that at the 6 month mark, there should be a bond hearing. That should trigger a bond hearing if somebody hasn't had one already. And the government says that there is no 6 month guarantee in the law that's spelled out. And Justice Sonia Sotomayor today pushed back on that kind of open-ended aspect of keeping people in custody.
You really can't keep someone indefinitely without a reason, basically. And that reason, I think you would concede, can't be just whim. We don't like this person because it's easy to point to a racial reason, but it could be something as simple as we just don't like them.
And the government lawyer said, no, that's not so.
That is not our position, Justice Sotomayor. We agree that, for example, there is a robust internal review process here.
And here, Carol, the government's legal team is saying that there is an internal review process by immigration officials over people's cases, and that it's up to the federal government and immigration officials to have discretion over whether somebody should be allowed out of detention or not. Overall, we'll see how the Supreme Court justices decide. There were plenty of tough questions for both sides today. If the court's conservative majority rules in favor of the government, this could leave immigrants detained in custody for indefinite periods. That could be the impact of these cases. We'll see how this plays out.
What are the alternatives to keeping undocumented immigrants in ICE custody?
The alternative would be to place an immigrant with an ankle monitor or some sort of electronic tracking device, and then folks would go back to their homes, their families, and their communities. It would be up to them to find a place to stay in the United States while they wait out their court proceedings from outside an immigration detention center. That is the alternative to detention option. That's what immigrant advocates are saying should be done instead of keeping people in ICE custody for long periods of time.
The World's Monica Campbell on immigration cases before the Supreme Court today. Thanks, Monica.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The World. Parenting is tough enough. Parenting during a pandemic can be brutal. But dads across the globe are finding a common role model, a cartoon Australian sheepdog, Bandit.
It's a support group. And we all have Bandit in common. We all try to be more like Bandit.
Bandit is playful, engaged, and patient, no matter how cranky he gets. The story of Bandit's followers just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Kazakhstan today, order has been restored, at least according to the country's president, Kasym Jomart Tokayev. Protests broke out across Kazakhstan last week following a sharp hike in fuel prices.
Основная миссия миротворческих сил ОДКБ успешно завершена.
Today, Tokayev said that Russian troops helped quell the unrest and that their mission was complete. Tokayev said troops from Russia and other nearby nations would begin leaving Kazakhstan within the next 2 days. Dakhan Umirbekov is an editor with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Kazakh service. He's in Nur-Sultan, the capital of Kazakhstan. Dakhan, has order in fact been restored in Kazakhstan?
In Nur-Sultan, the order is restored. In our largest city, Almaty, our colleagues in that city are also saying that the order is being restored. The public transportation starts working again. The banks are working, but it takes time to restore the damage.
Has the internet been restored as well?
Yes, it's the first time we are having the internet for a full day since the tragic events took place.
Darhan, tell us what you've witnessed over the past week or so.
So these protests started in the west of Kazakhstan with people protesting against the fuel price. The next day in Nur-Sultan, there were a couple of announced assemblies. I went to one of them where people gathered and they were airing their demands. After 5 or 10 minutes, the riot police came and detained them, and three policemen surrounded me, didn't allow me to move. I was filming them to my cell phone. When I raised my hand, they tried to cover my camera so that I couldn't film them. The next day, on January 4th, there were protests in several places in the capital, in Nur-Sultan. And I was at one of them, and there were like hundreds of people. I saw how the riot police was detaining. It was massive detainment. I was filming, and then the riot police detained myself. I was held at police station for 4 hours and a half and released without any charge. The next day, when the violent clashes were happening in cities like Almaty, Shymkent, the Nur-Sultan was quite calm. So we can say that the authorities in the capital managed to quell the protests.
There's been a lot of speculation, but how do you explain the events of last week? What are the prevailing theories in Kazakhstan?
So if you ask the analyst, there are many opinions. I've heard from many people that this was something that was organized. the inter-elite thing, not something that President Tokayev or the Russian President Vladimir Putin told about external factors. People in Kazakhstan don't believe in that kind of statements, like external factors or the West. One of the opinions is that it was organized by the surroundings of the first president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, who disagreed with his decision to deliver the power to President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev.
The current president.
Yeah, the current president. So they say that these are the wealthy people. They have power, they have money, and they were also close to Nazarbayev, but they disagree with his decision to hand the power to President Tokayev. They tried to sabotage Nazarbayev's decision and took power by force, and that they didn't expect Tokayev's move asking help from the Collective Security Treaty Organization.
Now, we mentioned that President Tokayev announced that troops from Russia and other countries that are part of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, they're going to be exiting Kazakhstan within 10 days. What do you make of this short deployment of foreign troops to Kazakhstan if they are in fact leaving?
For Tokayev, it was a positive thing because he lost the trust to the Kazakh KGB and the Kazakh authorities. And that's why he asked help from the President Putin and other members of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, because he couldn't trust his own army, his own forces.
That's interesting.
Yeah, for the people, they were opposing the idea of bringing Russian soldiers, because we know the Crimean annexation in 2014, it was super sensitive for Kazakh people. Like, after that, we became very, like, anxious about any statements from Russia or Kremlin towards Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan has changed enormously after these events.
Darkhan Umerbekov is an editor with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Kazakh service. He's been speaking to us from Nur-Sultan, the capital of Kazakhstan. Thank you so much, Darkhan.
Thank you.
20 years ago today, the first detainees dressed in orange jumpsuits filed into the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. More than 700 Muslim men and boys have now passed through its gates. Just 39 remain there. Of those, only a dozen have been formally charged with a crime. Shane Kadidal is a lawyer who represents Gitmo detainees. He's also with the Center for Constitutional Rights. I asked him what is preventing the closure of the detention camp at Guantanamo.
If you want to move every last prisoner out of that physical space, then you have to marshal the political capital to take the 12 people who are charged and move their cases to federal criminal court and bring them to the United States, all of which, you know, will present some substantial political hurdles, but it's probably the right thing to do from the standpoint of actually trying them in a legitimate criminal justice system, right? I really expect that they're going to clear every single person who's not charged, so that the 9 who are in this kind of indefinite detention, kind of nether category, they're eventually going to be cleared. I think the only reason they weren't cleared under Obama is that basically the vast majority of guys who are left were in the CIA prison system at some point in time. And the clearance process that's been used all the way back into the Bush administration requires unanimous agreement by all the relevant agencies. And I think the CIA basically kind of blackballed everybody who had been in its prisons because they didn't want the stories of what was done to people in those prisons to come out. And I think they also didn't want the identities of the countries where those prisons were located to come out, because that would have some bad implications for those countries diplomatically.
So you're saying most of the remaining Gitmo prisoners know what happened in CIA black sites, and so that's why they're being blocked from release?
They were being blocked for release up until last year. And then we started to see a wave of clearances of guys who always had very low-level factual allegations against them, but they had that one damning thing that they had been held for a year or a year and a half in one of the CIA black sites, right? There are 29 guys out of the 39 who are left who were held in CIA sites. So, you know, that has kind of been, up until last year, the defining feature of who wasn't cleared but also wasn't charged.
This week, a Somali man who's been held without charge at the detention camp in Guantanamo since 2006 learned he's been approved for transfer. His name is Gulad Hassan Duran. Does his approval create a precedent that could shake things up?
Well, he is the first, quote unquote, high value detainee. Right? And what that means is there was a group of 14 guys that includes the five who are charged in relation to the 9/11 attacks. So really, mostly the people of highest concern among everybody who was ever detained at Guantanamo. And he's the first, you know, of these so-called high value detainees. And I think the significance is that that he was held together for a long period of time with a bunch of these other people who suffered the very worst of the CIA's torture program. You know, a number of the guys who were waterboarded and so forth, right? You know, the whole idea of guys who were in the CIA detention program being cleared is kind of a watershed moment. It's been happening over the last year. But, you know, clearance is one thing and transfer is another. And there,
right. And the transfer meaning that a country has to decide to take him.
Well, it's more that the U.S. has to start the process of trying to move people to other countries. You know, one of the many sort of myths around Guantanamo is that the guys who are left are here because they have no place to go. No country wants to take them, or they're from some place that they can't go home to. And it's not really true. I mean, we have 11 Yemenis at Guantanamo, and the U.S. never wanted to send people to places like Yemen or to Somalia. But you could send those 11 guys, those 11 Yemenis, and maybe a bunch of the others who were in a similar situation to, for instance, Saudi Arabia's well-established rehabilitation program. I think most of them would accept going there. It shouldn't be that difficult. Obama managed to do it with several dozen men who couldn't go back to North African dictatorships pre-Arab Spring in 2009 and 2010. So I think we could pull it off for this much smaller group.
It sounds like you think this is a political will issue. I mean, President Biden has been in office almost a year. He hasn't yet appointed a special envoy for Gitmo, the closure czar, as they're called. Do you think the Biden White House will take that step?
You know, the cynic in me thinks that Biden hasn't named an envoy because he doesn't want transfers to happen before the midterms in November, and putting off naming an envoy is a way to do that. You know, I hope that's not the case. I think once we get a special envoy in place, it should be pretty routine to transfer out at least half of the guys who are already cleared. I mean, I think, you know, the Algerians, for instance, I represent a guy who was cleared under Obama and for whatever reason didn't manage to transfer him out in time. But he could go tomorrow if we had a special envoy. We've never had an issue with sending people back to Algeria. That's one of the most heavily policed countries in the Arab world. They've never had an issue with keeping close tabs on people that we've sent back.
Shane Katadal is a lawyer who represents Gitmo detainees. He's also with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Carol.
I'm about to hit you with the understatement of the century. Parenting is hard, especially in a pandemic. The World's Sarah Birnbaum heard from some dads who are finding help in an unlikely place.
Thomas Shanahan isn't ashamed to say it. His parenting role model is a cartoon dog, Bandit.
Often you say to yourself in a situation, what would Bandit do?
WWBD. Bandit is the dad on Bluey, an Australian TV show about a family of four sheepdogs. There's Bluey, a six-year-old, Bingo, her four-year-old sister, and their parents, Bandit and Chili. The show is aimed at preschoolers, but you'd never know that from the legions of adult superfans who binge-watch Bluey after their kids are asleep.
When the new season came out, my daughter would go to bed and I'd be like, right, it's time to watch Bluey.
Bluey launched in Australia in 2018 and became a global hit. Part of what makes the show so unique is that it focuses on the relationship of two girls with their dad. This is a real departure for television. Other cartoon dads tend to be lazy or inept.
Hard. I'm going to help you build that racer.
Thanks, but I'm almost done. Why don't you get back on the couch and watch TV?
Okay.
But Bandit, he's got mad dad skills.
He can see the good in everything. He doesn't swear in front of his kids. His time for Bluey and Bingo is almost unlimited.
Bluey, do you want cereal? Yeah, you want cereal.
He has an extraordinary imagination. There are episodes like Feather Wand, where he's able to be controlled by a feather wand.
I said cereal heavy.
Oh, what's going on? This is some heavy cereal. Must have a lot of fiber.
Or when he turns himself into a rag doll and forces the kids to drag him through the house.
Ready, go. He moved. Hooray. Now pull on that leg. I'll push his butt.
Since watching Bluey, I have found myself being a better dad.
Thomas has an example. At the beginning of the pandemic, Sydney, Australia was in a very strict lockdown, and Thomas and his family were stuck inside the house for 4 months.
There was a time when my daughter was going out of her skull.
So she was jumping around and...
In Australia, we'd say, I copped a knee to the nuts.
No need for translation there. Anyway...
When something like that happens and all you want to do is swear, that's when Bandit takes over and you just go, cheese and crackers! Or...
Oh, biscuits.
WWBD. In action. It was around the same time that Thomas was poking around on Facebook and found a group for dads who love Bandit. There are 8,000 members in this online community, and they're from all over the world. Matt Bellis in the UK started the group.
If an adult really likes a kid's TV show, sometimes it can be a bit embarrassing to talk about it. But I thought, if I get a fan group going, then other dads can go, hang on, I like the show as well, so we can talk about it.
Matt says it just evolved from there. The group became a place where dads could vent, ask for advice, or just talk about how they're feeling.
One dad posted saying that he struggles to find friends and that he struggles to talk to people, you know, and he was very reluctant to be open about it. So I dropped him a comment saying, look, you know, you can talk to us, feel free. And we've been speaking every day since.
Matt has struggled with mental health too. He got severely depressed after his son was born and says he could have used a Facebook group like the one he created.
Moms get all the support. And I don't mean this disrespectfully whatsoever. I really don't. But, you know, we're just as important as moms. And sometimes it's forgotten.
Thomas says there's not a lot of guidance out there for dads. And then you throw in all the stigma around being vulnerable.
It's very hard to reach out for help. It's not something that men do, and particularly Australian men. But that group, it's a support group. And we all have Bandit in common. We all try to be more like Bandit. And that allows people to connect and grow and help each other.
And be better dads in the process. Though if you accidentally drop an F-bomb, it's okay. I'm sure Bandit has his moments too. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Let's take a moment now to remember a hero. His name was Magawa. He was born in Tanzania and trained by a Belgian NGO to detect landmines in Cambodia.
Once a mine is found, the team calls in a bomb disposal expert to detonate the device.
Magawa helped experts destroy more than 100 landmines and unexploded bombs across the Cambodian countryside. In 2020, he was awarded a gold medal for his life-saving work.
Magawa is a true hero rat.
I suppose we should have said we're talking about an animal here.
Magawa's medal has been specially designed to fit onto his work harness.
Magawa wore that medal proudly until retirement last June. The landmine-sniffing rat died this past weekend at the age of 8. Another animal headline now, this one from Spain, about a badger. The furry mammal is thought to have accidentally dug up the largest collection of Roman coins ever to have been discovered in northern Spain. Archaeologists made the find in a cave last April, but their academic paper was just published. And while the paper focuses on the 209 ancient coins, it's the badger that's making the headlines. Researchers believe that the animal clawed through a crack in the cave in a desperate search for food, then left the Roman coins behind. No comment yet from the badger. Our third and final animal story also involves some digging, this time by paleontologists in England who found what's being called a sea dragon, the fossil of a marine dinosaur that resembled a shark or a dolphin. But this guy was huge, more than 32 feet long. His skull alone weighs a ton.
We took 14 and a half days to excavate this entire skeleton. That's working pretty much sunrise to sunset every single day.
That's paleontologist Dean Lomax, who led the excavation that has just been made public.
Not only is this the most complete ichthyosaur skeleton ever found here in the UK, incredible at 10 metres long, but it's actually the biggest prehistoric reptile skeleton ever found here as well. So it's incredible.
Incredible indeed. It's hard to find a lot of silver linings to this pandemic, but there might be one in Bulgaria. For many years, the Eastern European country saw thousands of its citizens move abroad for better jobs and opportunities. Then in 2020, the situation suddenly reversed. Now people in Bulgaria are wondering, will all those pandemic returnees stay put? Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Pascal Jelizov moved with his family from Bulgaria to North Carolina in 2007. He was 15 years old at the time. Zhelezov tells me his family have been trying to move to the US for years.
They were looking for a change, not only just economically, but also on the social side of things. My father, I think, has been applying for a green card for maybe a decade before he sort of, I guess, won the lottery.
After college, Zhelezov moved to San Francisco and began working with a business travel startup. But when the pandemic hit, his company suffered badly. Zhelezov found a job with another startup. This time, he was told he could work from wherever he wanted. So in May 2020, Zhelezov says he decided to move back to Bulgaria.
You always hear about these stories where people feel like they hit the jackpot when they were able to move to the US. I never really felt like an American who wants to live the American lifestyle and American life. And for me, Bulgaria was always home. It always felt like home.
Zhelezov is one of thousands of Bulgarians who moved home that year, many of them from Western Europe. Bulgarian journalist Oggy Georgiev says many came back because they felt safer at home.
The primary two reasons they gave was they were either left without a job or they were fearing for the security. I mean, health security, you know, they just felt more secure being back.
But Georgiev says no one yet knows if those returnees will stay long term. Bulgaria is one of the poorest countries in Europe. Corruption has long been a problem. Athanas Pekhanov served a stint recently as deputy prime minister, and he moved back from Austria to do the job. Pekhanov tells me many of his friends moved back home to Bulgaria too, but he's not sure if they're planning to stay.
For many of them, it also depends on the choice that their companies are making. So a lot of these people, they came here but are still working the job that they were working somewhere in Western Europe. And I think it will depend on the flexibility that companies will show towards relocating or working from abroad.
Last December, Bulgaria elected a new prime minister, Harvard-educated entrepreneur Kirill Petkov, who ran on a strong anti-corruption message. Speaking just hours after the election result, Petkov promised to end corruption and fix the justice system. Former Deputy Prime Minister Athanas Pekhanov says there's an air of optimism in Bulgaria right now.
I think people are really now hopeful that things can change, but I always say that it's going to take a while. It will take time. In the past decade, we neglected a lot of problems that we have, and now we have to face them straightforward, and it will take time to solve them.
But not everyone is so upbeat. Petar Cholakov is Associate Professor of Sociology at the Bulgarian Academy of Sciences.
During the last elections, only 40% of the constituents participated in the elections. 60% of the people, the voters, didn't go to the polls.
Maybe that shows people in Bulgaria just don't care about who's in government, Cholakov says. But then again, maybe he's being a bit too cynical.
What is even more interesting, I would say, is that Bulgarians, according to pessimism, remain in the top five countries in the world, according to the Worldwide Survey. So we're very pessimistic.
The first task facing the new government, though, is tackling the rising COVID infection rate, which isn't helped by Bulgaria's low vaccination numbers. But this will take time. Today, a government health official reported that the Prime Minister, the President, and several senior ministers have all gone into self-isolation after they came into close contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
In India, the rollout for the next round of COVID booster shots began this week, but one man there is well past jab number 3, a villager in eastern India who may in fact be the most boosted man on the planet.
The World's Chavi Sachdev joins me now from Mumbai. Chavi, so who is this man and how many shots has he gotten?
So his name is Brahmadev Mandal, and he claims he's had 12 vaccines in 11 months.
Oh dear, what's going on here?
So my colleague Umesh Roy was talking to him in his village, and this is what he told him. So he told him that his first shot had seemed to help not only his chronic joint pain, but his calcium deficiency as well, and even helped his appetite. So every time there was a vaccination camp, it helped so much that he went back for another and another and another for 11 months.
How could this happen? I mean, was he not recognized by the health staff who were giving these vaccines?
So the village level vaccination camps have a rotating staff and they go to different locations every time. They also don't really have electricity or internet or even computers sometimes. So they write down the registration information and the name of the person and take down their ID and go back and enter it into the system. The system didn't flag the ID until the 9th vaccine, at which point the health workers refused him a certificate. So then he switched IDs, but still got 3 more jabs.
Wow. I'm wondering what the reaction's been in India. I mean, a lot of people are waiting for their first shot, and this guy has had 12 shots, and it's a pandemic. It's a serious thing.
Our health workers, our doctors, just got their 3rd shot this week. So people are incredulous. I don't think there's so much outrage as just shock. The health department, of course, is massively embarrassed. And Umesh told me that they're trying to deal with it. And the authorities have started an internal investigation. And Umesh says that the report found a problem with the India-wide vaccination portal, which was letting people register with their universal ID as many times as they wanted.
So what's the latest?
The health department has now filed a police complaint against him for cheating and fraud. Yesterday, the police showed up at his house. I don't think he's been arrested yet. But what I do know is that Mandal is still hopeful that he can get more shots. That's Umesh telling me that the last time he talked to Mandal, he said he regretted that the news has gone viral because he wants to get at least 2 or 3 more.
Oh, boy. The world's Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai talking about the world's most vaccinated man. Thanks a lot, Chavi.
My pleasure, Carol.
Seriously, though, the current COVID vaccine and booster recommendations are based on research and ongoing evaluations. Scientists really don't yet know the impact of getting multiple added-on shots. So bottom line, don't try this at home. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.